88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinion.
Hopefully that woke you up. Good morning and welcome to this February 6th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website is Pen on Fire. My website is mariestone.com. Enough housekeeping. I'm your host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I'm joined for the full hour this morning by Tom Barbash. Tom is the American writer of fiction and nonfiction, educator and critic. He is the author of the novel The Last Good Chance, a collection of short stories, Stay Up With Me, and the best-selling nonfiction work On Top of the World, Cantor Fitzgerald, Howard Lednick, and 9/11. His fiction has been published in Tin House, Story Magazine, the Virginia Quarterly Review, the Indiana Review, elsewhere. Tom taught at Stanford University, where he was a Stegner Fellow, and he now teaches novel writing, short fiction, and nonfiction at the California College of the Arts. His latest is The Dakota Winters. It's published by Echo. And because we have the luxury of time this morning, hopefully we're going to talk about all of this stuff, but certainly this amazing new novel. Tom, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So the before we dive into the novel, and because we have the time, I thought maybe we could start with talking about your kind of origin story as a writer. I know once upon a time you were a journalist, and I was, you know, just kind of curious if you were one of those in utero writers, or did you kind of come to it over time, or let's just kind of talk about that.
Yeah, I don't know, Marie, if you know, you probably do those British documentaries, 35 Up, 42 Up,
oh, yeah.
Where what they do is they ask the kids what they want to be when they're 7, then when they're 14, then when they're 21, then when they're 28. And they have this thing where they discover that at 21, they're polar opposites of what they originally wanted to be. But around 28, they've kind of circled around and they're kind of close to the person they wanted to be when they were 7. So I think that's sort of my story, which is that I think at 7, I loved stories. I probably would have told you I wanted to be a writer. But at 21, when I was in college, I was heading to law school. And, I mean, I didn't go. And my story about that is a writer story, which is I was writing the essay about why I wanted to go to law school, and I found it very unconvincing and decided maybe I shouldn't do this. And I did become a newspaper reporter right out of college, and I was at the Syracuse Post-Standard, and I was stationed in a bureau in Oswego County. And the way I would describe it as an apprenticeship to become a novelist or story writer, your job when you're a reporter is to run around and look for stories and to listen to people whose experiences are very different than yours, which I think is – and also you just learn how to write lean sentences. So for me, it was pretty perfect to begin that way.
Yeah.
And then while I was there – I handed a series of stories. I did some features about the guys who ran away with the carnival at the state. They ran away with the carnival as kids, and they became these carny workers at the state fair. And I showed those to a novelist named Doug Unger, who shared them with his colleague Tobias Wolff. This was in Syracuse. Mm. And they let me into their writing workshops, their graduate writing workshops, when I really had no right to be in there. I'd only written one short story, and everybody else in the workshop was already publishing. So I had this big break. So that was my big break, you know, and then I got to be sitting in Tobias Wolff's workshop with so little experience, and then he wrote my recommendations. I went off to the University of Iowa and then Stanford, and, you know, and I've fiction has been what I've been writing ever since. I mean, I still go back and, you know, I wrote my book about Cantor Fitzgerald, that nonfiction book, but that was how I started out.
Damn. Well, I did go to law school, and I can tell you that you made the right choice there, because that's it. I want to circle back.
I come from a family of lawyers, you know, so I think we'd had enough. Not enough lawyers. They were happy to see someone doing something different.
Right. I don't know about you in journalism, but in the law, it took a lot of unlearning stuff to learn fiction. Like, it was not only just learning how to write fiction, but it was learning how to unlearn legal writing, and I don't know if that's true of journalism as well. Like, was there a kind of an unlearning curve to get yourself from journalism speak to fiction speak?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's, I mean, it's something that I teach right away. I sort of have to teach students how to see the world differently. And the biggest thing, it's sort of on some elementary level, is point of view. There's this John Gardner exercise I always start with, where I have that exercise where you tell them, describe a city street from the point of view of someone who's in love, but you can't mention that they're in love, you know, anything about it. Just describe the details of the street and the weather, et cetera. And then you describe that same street from the point of view, or I do, of someone who's just lost a job that's important to them. Don't mention the loss of the job, but you teach them how to render psychology through point of view. And that's not something you do, you know, in your in your city hall story. You're writing for the newspaper. That aspect of point of view and you know, sort of rendering psychology through the selection of detail and description of atmosphere. And that was sort of a big jump. But I would say the other thing is, you know, along that lines is I was talking about this recently at a reading. Someone asked me this question. And I think when I decided that I wanted to do this was when I began to write in a voice that didn't seem like it was my own. It was a different person's consciousness. You know, when you look at my short stories, you know, when I wrote those, I have people who are all different age groups and different genders and have different educations, and some of them are different. And it was so mysterious to me that I could write in a different cadence, you know, a different thought process than my own. And that kind of mysterious feeling of, like, I don't know where this is coming from, but it's interesting to me, and following that once I had a few experiences of doing that, I thought, this is what I need to do.
It's interesting you should say that, because after I finished Dakota Winters, then I picked up your short story collection. And a lot of times you can, you know, pick up a novel and say, yep, that's Tom Barbash or that's whatever. And that was not my experience with your short stories. Like, I picked up each one and I'm like, damn, he's completely different. And,
right.
It really wasn't a total unity of voice. And I was like, ah, that's skill. I mean, that's really difficult to do, I think. And that the story is dictating the voice rather than the author is dictating the voice. And I don't know, was that there all along? Like, did you feel like that you had to work at the voice of each work? Or, you know, was that pretty organic, or was that really a conscious decision?
Yeah, I think it's pretty. I think people have different ways of describing themselves as writers, and some work in a kind of straightforward autobiographical way, and they're always mining certain things that have happened in their past. And then I would say that I'm more of an empathic writer, and that I listen a lot, and I try to figure out the sort of things that haunt other people, things that other people desire, et cetera. And then I latch on to a certain, you know, someone I've known or something, you know, a character sort of comes from my imagination, but it's probably based on a collection of people. And then, you know, once I have that voice, that longing, those obstacles, I can pretty much start writing it. And sometimes it happens pretty quickly. A lot of the stories that stay up with me, the sort of first draft was written in one long breath. Others took me a lot longer to get, but yeah, it is. I mean, I remember listening to a bunch of writers being interviewed during one stretch, and they were all writers I admired, and all of them talked about an aspect of method acting, that it was sort of figuring out who this character was and sitting down at the word processor and becoming them in the process of writing. And I think that happens a lot to me.
Right. My guest this morning is Tom Barbash. The book we are just going to start talking about is The Dakota Winters, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So let's do that. Let's jump into that for a little bit, and I'm going to let you kind of take us into Anton's world and introduce us to that, and then we'll use that as a foundation to sort of jump off and talk about it.
Okay, yeah. So The Dakota Winters is a story about a fictional family who live in the building, the Dakota, in the final year of John Lennon's life. So it began with that idea of a family that would be neighbors of John. And so it began with that, with the year 1980, with the neighborhood, the Upper West Side, which is where I grew up. I grew up five blocks away from the Dakota in the 70s and 80s. And then I clued into this family, and the most important thing really for the book is the relationship between the 23-year-old son, Anton, and his 49-year-old father, Buddy Winter, who is a national talk show host, loosely based, kind of like a little bit of Dick Cavett, a little bit of Johnny Carson. He, in the book, he used to write for Carson and was friendly with him. And 2 years before the start of the novel, the father, Buddy, has a nervous breakdown. It comes over time, but he walks off his own show and then sort of goes on this journey of self-discovery and has a nervous breakdown. And the son goes off to the Peace Corps kind of to escape his father. He grew up on the show, helping his father, being sort of the other side of his father's brain, his father likes to call it. And then when he returns to New York with a case of malaria, the two of them convalesce together a little bit, and then they team together to try to get Buddy a new show. And meanwhile, it's in the middle of John Lennon trying to figure out his second act. You know, he's had 5 years off from making music, and he's been a diligent father, and now he has a resurgence during the year, and a lot of adventures ensue.
A lot of adventure. I love that. One of the things that really drew me to this was this idea of taking a real life character and, you know, creating a kind of a fictional world around them. And I'd love to sort of explore how you, I mean, the challenge of that is that, well, there's a ton, I'm sure, but two of them are that you have to get this guy just right. And you have to say something very new about him that would, you know, this very overexposed personality who isn't at the center of the novel, but, you know, we have to understand a new dimension of him from a different angle. And so talk a little bit about that, about getting, we'll just start with the John Lennon character, kind of getting him really right, but in a fresh, new, unexpected way.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. And he is sort of at the center of it, which I discovered. I didn't know quite how big a role that you know, he would play, but he plays a very large role. And you're right in that when I set out to do it, I didn't want to repeat a whole bunch of things that people half understood about John, and I wanted to say something new. And there were some great sources. I was helped by the memoir of his personal assistant, Fred Seaman, and then there was also one by his tarot card reader, John Green. There was a book that was a little bit helpful. I read a lot of the different biographies, and then I read his own writing. I had his collected letters. But the thing that I keyed in on, one of the best things was that his assistant had kept a list of all the different books that John read, his interest from month to month. So I read the different books and articles that John was reading so I could figure out what he was obsessing about and thinking about. And so what I drew from that last year, which I thought was, I hadn't seen explored in other books, was one, it was all about being a father and reflecting on his own, you know, his own father left John when John was two, and he was a merchant seaman. He went off to sea, and John didn't really see him much until he was six. And when his father returned, he kidnapped John, 6-year-old John, and took him to Blackpool, a seaside town, and fed him full of sweets and took him on rides for 3 weeks, at which point John's mother, Julia, shows up, stands at the door, and the story is that John, 6-year-old John, had to choose between his father and mother. And he first chose his father, and then his mother started walking away, and he ran to her. And then he didn't see his father again until he was a Beatle, and his father showed up at one of his shows with his father's 19-year-old girlfriend, who became his wife. So, but the thing about that, so keying on what was unique about John was he had been so absent in Julian's life, and in the last few years of his life was a very active father with Sean and was making amends with Julian. And secondly, that he dreamt as a kid of going to sea because his father was away at sea. So in the last year of his life, he began to read stories of great sea voyages. He read the Kon-Tiki. He read other things by Thor Heyerdahl and also by Sir Francis Chichester, who circumnavigated the globe in boats by himself. And he learned how to sail. He bought a boat, the Isis, and he learned how to sail off Cold Spring Harbor, where he had a house. And then he chartered a boat to go off to Bermuda, which becomes a big centerpiece to see, and it's based on a true story of John's role in battling through a huge storm in the Bermuda Triangle. So these notions of wanting to escape fame and the constant sort of imprisonment of being John Lennon by going off to sea and watching the land disappear and feeling like he's nowhere, he's anonymous in some way or equal to all the people on the boat. And also connecting to his past, you know, and then also just being a father. So those things, and the story of Anton and Buddy is really a story about fatherhood and an abandonment of a father. So a lot of these themes started to come together. So I felt like, as I had what I felt like was a new take on John, I figured out a lot of things about the central relationship in the book.
What I really love about that, as from a writing perspective, is that it gives you, I always talk about, you know, fiction writing as being like thrown into the center of a swimming pool. And if you don't have anything to push off from, it's very difficult to just sit there with your blank screen. But if you have something, and John Lennon feels like a really wonderful something to push off from to, you know, give you at least enough kind of context or contours to create a story around. And then the research will sort of dictate to you and inform you about the other characters in the story. It's a nice thing that, you know, talking about being lost at sea, it's nice for a writing perspective.
Yeah, and I love
nice.
Your image, you know, that kind of image of needing something to push off of. I think that's great. I'm going to steal that. Because there is that. And then also, you have this, I mean, I suppose people who set their novels in 1968 feel the same way, but I began to feel that there was no year like 1980, because you think of what this year was in our country. We had, you know, we began with the hostage crisis, which lasted the whole year. And then we had the in January, the Russian invasion into Afghanistan. We had a government turnover in Rhodesia. We had a really volatile crazy presidential primary season with Kennedy and Carter, and then the presidential election, the Reagan-Carter presidential season. And we had the Olympic win over the Russians, and then the boycotting of the Summer Olympics. And it just seemed like everything was happening. And in New York, it was a really dark time in the city's history. I mean, the 70s were, but it hadn't turned around in 1980. And there was a lot of people being pushed in front of subway trains, you know, crime, you know, acts of violence, pointless acts of violence, and a kind of end-of-the-world feeling. I mean, no one could see the future at that point and see what the turnaround for the city would be. So as I keyed into the year became a character, in essence, you know, something else to push off from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Imagine what they'll write about our time. Imagine 30 years from now what they'll be saying
exactly.
About us.
Well, I don't know. You know, people are trying to write about our time, and maybe we're going to need 20 or 30 years to write, you know, to write the right kind of novel about what's happening right now.
Don't you think that's true? Yeah. I mean, that's another thing I was going to ask you about, is having sort of the distance of not only the distance from, because now you live in California, so the distance that geography gives you to view New York in a different light, and the distance of the, you know, 30, 40 years that kind of, I do think things kind of crystallize and allow a writer to see things a little bit more clearly than they could if you wrote this novel in 1982.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, another aspect, this is, you know, I like that idea of needing the distance. I also thought, I mean, having, it wasn't the only reason, but having Anton go away to the Peace Corps allowed my central voice, my narrator, to look at New York anew, you know, to have this into now he's going to, you know, he's not going to see it just as someone who grew up there and stayed there, having gone away and had a completely different experience. He can have fresh eyes on New York, and that was helpful to me. But also, yes, having the distance to write about it. And there are pleasures. I think a lot of readers who've been responding to me, you know, have said that it's pleasurable for them when they read the book to escape 2018 or 2019 now, you know, and go back to 1980, to just spend, you know, a few nights, you know, whatever it takes to read the book, in another time period. And for me, it was a pleasure to, you know, to sort of to be in that year every day. I'd go in and read the New York Times in 1980 and look at the New Yorker in 1980 and listen to the music in 1980. It was a lot of fun.
Something you said earlier also jogged my memory about, is it Emily St. John, whoever wrote the Station 11, I think St. John. She was talking about how we're all invested. Each generation is invested in thinking that they are living through the end of times. And I kind of keep having to remind myself of that today, you know, in today's world, that maybe we just feel like we're invested in living through the end of times. But your comment about that's how it felt in 1980, and now we look back on 1980 as so quaint and, you know, idyllic.
Right.
But yeah, maybe that is something the human condition is just always invested in, is feeling like, this is it. This is, I get to be here to see the end. And
Yeah, and you know, but there's something I think that's totally true. And another thing that I failed to say about 1980, because this is a TV family, which is what was happening in TV in 1980. So until then, through those of us, you know, who lived through the 70s, remember the days of the three networks. That was all, you know, everybody watched NBC, ABC, and CBS. But right around there, so ESPN starts at the end of 79, CNN starts in 1980, MTV starts in 81, HBO subscriptions and Showtime subscriptions are really kicking in that year, and you've got the TV landscape is totally changed, and music is going through this big upheaval too. So within the arts and entertainment, which is where the story is centered, there are big upheavals and changes.
Right.
So, and that's something I hadn't remembered, right, as I was researching, I was like, wow, everything's changing, and a TV family would be very aware of all that.
Right, right. Well, I should add the postscript to St. John's comment is that we're all right, you know, that each period kind of is the end of times. And now that you're saying that, that's right. The 1980s really was the end of a particular time that really fundamentally changed how we consume news and consume culture and all of that. So you're right. I mean, in a sense, and with Lenin's death, I mean, that really was sort of the end of a time that was really important in American
Absolutely.
History. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Mike, I would say, too, that it was funny that when you mark it with John's death, which is, so two of the things that the Winter family is connected to, I think, are these lingering dreams of the 60s. So if you think about the most iconic things of the 60s, I would say it's the Kennedys and the Beatles, you know. And so the dream that's still left as we go into 1980, we still have the dream of a Kennedy presidency, which is very alive, and that people think of Teddy Kennedy's run as doomed in retrospect, but the summer before, it was sort of his to lose. There was a lot of excitement about his run, his finally running. They'd been wanting to run forever. And there was still a lot of enthusiasm about a Beatles reunion. So those are the two things. And the book really goes into both of those, because Emily Winter, who's the mom, you know, and Buddy's wife, works on the Kennedy campaign and is friends with Joan Kennedy, so she's invested in that. And then Anton's invested in Beatles reunion. And those are the things, by the end of the year, those dreams of the 60s, you know, that's the end of it. That those things that we stayed with all the way through the 70s, we kept those dreams alive, and they were both gone by the end of the year.
Right, right. Good point. My guest this morning is Tom Barbash. We are talking about the Dakota Winters. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So you just did a massive amount of research for this, not only into John Lennon's life, as we talked about, but also reading the New York Times, the New Yorker, and probably all those magazines, newspapers, all that stuff, a massive amount of research. So I'd love to talk about sort of A, the scope of that, and B, the organization of that, and C, the timing of that. Like, did you sit down in advance of this novel and consume, organize, and then feel like you were okay to sit down and write, or did you kind of do it as you were going along?
Both. I think the first thing is to dive into the year, you know, start looking things and writing down things that strike you as interesting. The nice thing, you have to sort of, I mean, it was helpful that since my family are working on a contemporary, at the time, talk show, the notion of being knowledgeable that all these things in politics and culture make sense, because it's what they would consume every morning as they plan a monologue. So it wasn't sort of, it didn't feel as much like I'm just putting all that texture in, you know, there's a purpose, because, of course, a kid whose job it is to consume media to help his father write his monologues and interview his guests, it made more sense that he'd be on top of all that. But so there was the first idea of sort of getting to know the year a little bit. But then later on, I had the pleasure of, as I was sort of figuring out what my characters are doing, like I know which movies are playing at which theater, so I send, you know, Anton and Kip have this scene where they go to see the movie The Fog, you know, and that becomes a sort of part of it there. That whole night and what they take from that film gets woven into the book. And The Fog had opened that week, and I know what the posters look like, and the posters are around the city in different places. So you have that, and you can see which bands are playing at which clubs. And I had this club in the Upper West Side I used to go to called Hurrah's, and I go on the internet, and there's a DVD you can get with like 12 shows from that year. Can't believe it. So it has. But I remember my own memories. I mean, I have a recollection of a show where the lead singer for the Dead Boys had a cut finger and kept playing with the cut finger, and he was splattering blood everywhere. It was a crazy moment from my club past. Of course, that found its way into the book. So,
right.
So it's a combination of lived experience, and the research. And I guess the key to the research is to hide it, is to hide the fact that it's been researched. You have to know it so that it feels lived and that, like, it's breathing and living and not like a big chunk of research dropped down.
Sure, yeah. Right. Do you have a sailing background? There's so much wonderful sailing, specific sailing.
Thank you so much. No. I took sailing classes to research it, and I have lots of friends who gave me books to read, and I did a lot of study on how someone would teach a novice sailor, and also took some lessons, and then read a lot of journal accounts of storms at sea, and did a lot of research about storms in the Bermuda Triangle. And then the most fun aspect of it is so John chartered this boat with a man named Captain Hank Halstead, who sailed him, and they sailed through the Bermuda Triangle, and they had this spectacular storm, which John ends up, everybody sort of ends up being sick, and John sails the boat successfully through the storm, singing filthy Liverpool shanties at the top of his lungs. And the man he was with, this Hank Halstead, who was his captain and used to work at a drug clinic and ran rock and roll shows, he'd become a mythical figure to me. So I actually looked him up and called this number, and he actually answered the phone, and we set up two appointments, and we talked about it. I got goosebumps talking to him. I just couldn't believe, because I knew this was part of the novel, and it was like calling one of your characters. Getting him to talk to you. It was wonderful. So that was really helpful and really enjoyable.
That's so cool. Well, I would be delinquent if I didn't ask you about the Dakota and your research the Dakota is a character itself, as well as New York is a character.
Absolutely.
Itself, but and there's some really wonderful, great history about the building in here. But talk a little bit about accessing that place.
Yeah, well, I had the advantage of having friends of my stepmother's lived there, a family, and they invited me in and gave me a tour. And then I have a writer friend, Nina Solomon, who grew up there, and she took me on another tour and showed me her favorite part, which was the 8th and 9th floors, which is this, again, you set up well the question about John Lennon as a writer. What can you say that's new about John Lennon? And with the Dakota, what can you say that's new that people don't know about Dakota? And the history is great, but some people know the history. I was really helped by a few books. One, Stephen Birmingham's great book about the Dakota had tons of great details. But the thing I discovered on the tour was the 8th and 9th floor, which is where people had servants' quarters or their cooks. They had storage rooms. People's mistresses lived up there. And it's a completely different world. The lower floors, have these incredibly high ceilings and all the fireplaces. And, it's just grand New York apartments. And the apartments up there, some of them didn't have bathrooms or showers. They had shared bathrooms down the hall. The carpet sort of smelled. It's very different existence. Different times in the Dakota's history, supposedly they didn't even know who was living up there, who was paying for the place. So it was like a reverse upstairs, downstairs. And it solved a problem for me with the book, which is, that I felt like I wanted Anton to live in the Dakota, but I didn't know about having a 23-year-old young man still living in his parents'. And from what I knew of Anton, it didn't make sense that he'd live in his parents' home. But instead, he takes care of this writer's, who's often on his travels in Spain. He takes his apartment and takes care of his plants, etc. But that allowed me into that world, to stay in the Dakota, but have him feel independent in some way.
Right.
But it was... The original concept of the Dakota, for those who don't know, was at a time, the reason why it was called the Dakota supposedly was that the Upper West Side looked like the Great Plains. There was nothing there. And they built this luxury hotel. They had a staff of 250 originally. They had a grand dining room. They had a croquet lawn and a tennis court downstairs. And it was a type of place, people put it that Marlene Dietrich, I mean, she wasn't around then, but where where the glamorous and wealthy would like to live. They could live this kind of the kind of life you'd have in a great hotel, but they could lead that, you know, as their daily existence. And you know, and it looks like this big. In my childhood, it looked like this big haunted castle. And I asked Nina about it once. I said, it always looked haunted to me. And she said, it felt a little haunted to her, too, when she grew up there. So.
Well, Rosemary's Baby didn't help that. Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, I just saw that recently. So, yeah, and it scares you, doesn't it? I mean, that first shot and that eerie music, you think, I wouldn't live in that building.
Oh, my God, right.
Although you want to in some ways because it's so majestic and has such a great history and all these fascinating people live within.
I didn't realize that, was it when it was a hotel or was it when it was apartments that they would have these like grand dinners downstairs and the residents could order like room service, like foie gras up to their room or something?
That was in the old days. It was never a hotel. It was always
apartments.
Always
okay.
People lived there, but it was run like one. So yes, so they would send a waiter to your door. You could, and they'd actually bring in, you know, linens and you know, fancy cutlery and serve you dinner. Yeah, and you could have foie gras and oysters and exactly, you could have this incredibly glamorous existence, which people did back then. All these great New York families.
That is so good. That's so good. Yeah, I didn't know a lot of the history, so I was grooving on that too. That was really wonderful. It was great.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think if we look. We never see the movies in New York. A lot of them look at that West Side, you know, where you see beginning, you see the Dakota, you see the San Remo, you see the Beresford and the El Dorado, those great castles on the Upper West Side. And they're all built close to the same time period with a lot of the same kind of design principles. And they're just, it's so much of what we think of when we think about Manhattan.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Tom Barbash. The book, The Dakota Winters, is what we're talking about. We might talk about some short stories here in just a moment. You're listening to KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing. So I hate to drag you through the slog of the writing process, but I would love to sort of pick your brain a little bit about what this looked like. So you sat down at the blank screen. Did you write a draft sort of beginning to end and then massage? Let's talk a little bit about the process of getting this from head to paper and kind of what that looked like.
Yeah, no, I think I started first with the kind of research stuff. We said a whole bunch of details of place in time. And then I had this concept of the talk show host. And I started to write about Buddy, sort of to write from a son's perspective of what it was like to grow up on his father's show, what sort of a show it was. And I was lucky enough to be able to interview Kazuo Ishiguro a bunch of years ago down in the peninsula. He had in Menlo Park. And I had this question about whether he ever got stopped, you know, and why, you know, sort of not some version of writer's block. Mm-hmm. And he said that at some point he realized that he was overemphasizing character. And so that was interesting. I thought that doesn't make any sense. And he said, what was most important, he said, are relationships. And so that struck me as like, instead of focusing on a character out of context of being a son or a husband or a friend, understanding a particular dynamic. And so the engine for this book, at first I was sort of just exploring the world of the story, but when it sort of took off was understanding that it was about the dynamic between father and son, the son who worships his father, who grew up on his father's show, and then his father becomes dependent on him. And I would say if there's a carryover from the novel to the stories, I seem to be very interested in this changing dynamic of parents and adult kids. When the first time a parent seems to be vulnerable in the eyes of an adult kid, and when the kids start to act more like adults, and that shift of power. And there's a strange thing that happens in this book, which is that Anton becomes very good at writing monologues for Buddy, at asking the right kind of questions, and Buddy begins to think that he can't do this without his son, and Anton begins to think, I can't do this forever. Just I need to find my own path. So. That was such a big part of figuring out the book was to really sit with that relationship and look at the, you know, how they pushed each other and pulled each other and you know, what the draw was between them and what the problems were.
And at what point was that kind of importance of that revealed to you in the writing process? You know what I mean? Like you were know, you kind of halfway through, or how?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was. I hadn't yet written a draft, but I'd had a lot of time with the book. But I had to. I think at first I just ran with this kind of enthusiasm and fun with it, and then I had to sort of figure out, well, what are the issues between them, and then I dug into that. So, it's, you know, I didn't just work right through a draft, because I would sort of fine tune early sections. I kind of have the feeling sometimes when I'm writing that it's kind of a waste of time if I don't get things on an early, if I don't need to understand everything, but I need to have something that's psychologically precise, at least for that moment of time, you know, in the book, so that I can build beyond it. But if I'm so distant from the characters that I don't understand that relationship, I don't understand who each of them are, and I'm just piling up pages, that seems like a waste of time for me. So yeah. So to try to figure out at least that, you know, to write towards page 50 or 60 and get that right, that seemed to me a better exercise than just plowing through the whole book. So I was fine-tuning along the way, I would say.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, this relationship between John Lennon and his dad, and how that, you know, kind of quietly ripples underneath Anton and Buddy's relationship. And I don't know if that was, I mean, it sounds like happy circumstance, or you discovered that about John and his dad and then said, ah, that could really inform what's going on with these two people.
It was, and you've probably had this happen, Murray, too, and when you're writing, when you start to dig into something, and then all of a sudden all these gifts start emerging, all these things, you start to see these resonances everywhere. And so I was seeing a lot of that. And then something that was interesting was that there was almost, and someone else pointed this out to me, and I realized it was happening, is there's almost a triangle between Anton and Buddy and John, and there's a line where Anton says, you know, that it struck him that John had taken him on his great adventure, and his father on his great adventure had failed to do so. So in a way, John starts to play a little bit of that role. But John is encouraging of Anton and Buddy, and is very much, you know, very sympathetic to Buddy's issues, having been a celebrity in exile. You know, there's a lot of connection on that front. But yeah, you start. I think what you do is you take these issues that you're grappling in one part of your story, and you start seeing them in other parts, and that's when you really feel like you're cooking gas. Like, now here all these different parts are cohering, and that's a really great place to be. And it's difficult though, because you're just sitting over it, waiting for these resonances, trying to figure out what they mean, you know, and where the book should go. But you know you're on the right path at that point when things start to come together thematically.
Yeah, right. I loved your short story collection so much, and I was wondering if you feel sort of, you know, I always ask writers if they feel sort of essentially a short story writer, essentially a novelist, and, you know, for you, I just wouldn't want to choose, but do you have a feeling in yourself, like, where your center of gravity lies in terms of, you know, whether you really like that compressed form, or if you kind of liked the more expansive, whatever the novel gave you?
Oh, I like them both, and I like going back and forth from them, because I feel there's something about being at the end of a novel. I mean, I'm really excited about the next project, and it's going to be a novel, but at the last stages of writing the book, and you're working so hard, and you're trying to see new stuff, and sometimes it's really difficult. And at the end of it, I was thinking, I'm not sure I want to do this again. This is just, and one of the things that's nice is then you write stories because they're the projects are smaller, they're more intense, and it's a nice thing to do as a break from novel writing, but also story writing is its own sort of pressure. I mean, I think that what I always say is that stories need to be, until they're perfect, they suck. So it's meaning not, you know, I guess I'm not saying that my stories are the best stories in the world or whatever, but I don't want to change anything within them. And until I get to that point, they don't work. And they're not like almost there. They literally, if you get things wrong within a story, and which is different than a novel. I think novels can have, I think sometimes imperfections in a novel are what make it great. So there's a and there's something then to move from the demands of writing short stories and the looseness you can sometimes have in novel writing that's really fun. So I like both forms, and I intend to go back and forth between them.
It was really fun to watch your, as you mentioned before, you obviously have this really wonderful fascination with that newly adult child and their parent relationship, and that came through a lot in the short stories as well. And as soon as I finished the novel and then I picked up that first short story in the collection, I was like, oh, my God, here it is. Yeah. Here are these crazy parents. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind if we took, I think it's easier to do this with short stories than it is to do it with a novel, but we could do it with the novel too. But if we took one or two of these stories and kind of dissected them from sort of original concept of how that story even came as a germ in your head, and then how you kind of worked through it and what surprised you about it, and working through that. Okay.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah. It doesn't work now, but now it really works.
Right.
I don't know which one. I mean, Somebody's Son sort of makes sense.
It was such a surprise to me.
So
Somebody's Son is, yeah, it's, so I was a bureau reporter in upstate New York. And, so I have a few stories, in which I have someone from downstate who goes 4 or 5 hours north and finds a completely different world. And for me, it was startling and kind of great. It was a great experience for me to do, but it was, you know, it was a real eye-opening experience. And there are these downstate young men who are trying to buy homes from people in the Adirondacks and trying to pay a price, a much lower price than what it would warrant, given what they want to do, which is to subdivide the place and turn them into cash-making, you know, real estate deals. And I had read about a short article in our newspaper, the Post Standard, which was about people who would ingratiate themselves in the community, you know, and then would get people to sell their homes for much less than they were worth. And I have a narrator, so I started with that. My narrator is sort of is reluctantly doing it, and he's not the best con man because he very much wants to get caught, and he starts stealing things from the family, little tchotchkes, and literally holding them at his side so that they'll bust him, you know, which is in a way of wanting to be caught on that front. And then things progress from there. So I started with that, and then the story has sort of an interesting ending that I don't want to give away. Mm. But I think one of the things I sometimes tell my students, which is important in this story, is your secondary characters don't know that they're secondary characters. They think they're the protagonists in the story. So they have their own agendas going into things, and they're not just there to serve the agenda of your main character. So while you're building a story, especially from, you know, first-person narrator, and you're in that world, you can neglect the fact that someone else that's entering into the picture has completely different motivations. And that was my discovery in that short story, was the different agenda that Mrs. Berner, this other character in the story, might have.
That's interesting. So I'm thinking through this because I was going to come at that same question in sort of a different way, but now that you're saying it this way, it kind of makes more sense. But I was always thinking of stories as having sort of two threads or three threads, or that kind of are braided through, that there's the text and the subtext and the, you know, and maybe the even deeper subtext that all get kind of woven together. And a lot of these stories, I saw that going on, that there's the thing going on and then there's this other thing going on. And then, you know, at the very end, there's, oh, my God, yet another thing going on that we didn't perhaps see.
Well, I always think of that a little bit. So what you want to do in some way, you reach the end of the story and the reader suddenly realizes they've been reading a completely different story than they thought they were reading. Mm-hmm. And when they go back through it, they see that the threads are there. But it's basically you're usually doing two or three things at once, and you're pointing the reader's attention here, but you're still doing these other things. And so when there's this surprise at the end, if the reader goes back through, they can see the trail of that surprise. It didn't come out of nowhere. And that's part of the trick, the sleight of hand that you do when you're writing these things.
And does that happen for you as the writer as well? Was there a point in that story where you're like, oh, my God, I didn't know she was doing.
Yes, yes, very much so.
Okay.
I mean, the famous line from Flannery O'Connor, where she's talking about good country people, and she says that she didn't know until a paragraph before that the Bible salesman is going to steal the girl's wooden leg, and she's writing it, and then she literally gasped and thought, oh my God, he's going to steal her wooden leg. And I think that when we're working well, we have that. In the first story, I mean, I have this story of the break, and there's this mother, and she doesn't really like this hostess, pizza parlor hostess, who's dating her son. I had no idea she was going to hit the hostess. She's having this conversation with her, and I had that kind of feeling that Flannery O'Connor describes. I thought, I can't believe she just did that, and then it felt right that she did it, but it did startle me a little bit while I was writing it.
It's funny because that was the experience of reading it. I was like, oh my God. And then I thought, I wonder if he thought, oh my God, what,
I did. You probably had that. All have that occasionally. It's because you create characters who have their own volition. And I think non-writers have trouble believing that. They just believe that we just decide what they do. But we can try to make them do things. And if they wouldn't do it, that's when you just freeze. That writer's block often happens because the characters turn to you and say, I wouldn't do that, and if you try to force it, they're like actors are going to walk off the job. So.
Yeah. And it's almost probably a good nod to a writer. If that didn't happen to you, maybe you should go back and keep working on it. Maybe it's not done yet. If you were never
totally
surprised.
There's a famous story that John Gardner tells in On Becoming a Novelist, and I always tell students this, that he says that he had a character, and she was at a cocktail party, and someone offers her an hors d'oeuvre, and he realizes that he couldn't tell whether she took the hors d'oeuvre or not, so he stopped writing for a week. And that makes no sense to anybody who isn't a writer. It's just, so who cares? But he's like, he had no idea. He realized who she was at that point. And it was really obvious to him in that moment. So he had to take some time off and figure it out.
Yeah. Interesting. To that point. So I hate to say it this way. I was talking to Tim O'Brien a couple weeks ago. But he put something in my head that has kind of stopped me from writing ever since he said it. And that is that he will sacrifice content for he will sacrifice some of what he a meaning of a sentence for the sound of a sentence, that he is really guided by every cadence, rhythm, the structure of the sentence means more to him than what the sentence is trying to say. And it's sort of paralyzed me in a writing way since he said it. And so now I'm kind of picking people's brains on what they think of that. If each, kind of the movement and sound and whatever of.
See, I'm fascinated by it. He's one of my favorite all-time writers. And I got to meet him when he came and visited Iowa when I was there. I picked him up at the airport. But I would say that maybe he's not really talking about sacrificing meaning. He might be talking about sacrificing the intended meaning. Mm. Because I think if it sounds right to you, it's often because in a deep sense the meaning feels right to you. But I sort of disagree. If he means it literally, I completely disagree with him, because I am a writer who, for a while, was imprisoned in elegant musical sentences that meant nothing. Like, I'd write these sentences that sounded great to the ear, but they didn't connect to meaning in any way, and it was awful writing. And I tell my students that I would rather them begin with something that's true and inelegant and unmusical, and then they can find the music later. But I do, I think the idea is like that sort of intended, if you start with an intention of what you're trying to get across, and maybe within finding those sounds, but I don't find any, with Tim O'Brien's writing, they're musical and they're very connected to meaning,
yes,
I think. So
right.
I'm not so sure that he's sacrificed anything by working that way.
Right. Or maybe you sacrifice what literally, it's a whole different topic, but this idea that you're really trying to make a accurate account of what happened, and you'll sacrifice some of
yes.
that for a truer, deeper meaning of what feels emotionally true versus what factually may have happened.
That is definitely true, But another thing is, I went to a talk that George Saunders gave, and it resonated with me, and almost it seemed like all writers were saying the same thing, that part of it was cautioning apprentice writers from needing to know the meaning of things too early, you know, and needing to live in a state of not confusion but of mystery for and not knowing what things are going to add up to for a long time. And that adage of, is if you don't discover something in the course of reading your story or your novel, your reader certainly won't. And I think that that's exactly right.
And it's such a hard place to live for so long, that place of uncertainty, and am I just wasting my time, and, you know, should I abandon this, and how long do you know? I should put that to you. How long do you know you should be kind of holding yourself to the flame versus this just doesn't have what it needs and I should let it go? Have you abandoned
that? Well, you know, I don't know. Have you ever had Richard Bausch on your show?
Yeah, I love him. Yes.
Yeah, well, so... He has. I'm lucky enough. I was on a panel with him years ago, and I wouldn't say we're friends, but we're Facebook friends at this point. And I think he knows about me, and I certainly am worshipful of him. But he does these. He was doing these Facebook posts that were gorgeous meditations, and he still does them from time to time. I'm sure they're going to be put into a book about the writer's struggles. And at one point, when I was right in the place that you're talking about, that impossibly difficult place of figuring things out. He wrote this, I'll have to find it, I'll send it to you, but it was about embracing difficulty and understanding at the moment that it's most difficult, this is a sign that you're really on to something. And it happened right at the right time that I read that, and it was very important to me, you know, to sort of feel like it's not a bad sign if it's getting really difficult, that it's the opposite. It's actually the best sign you could have. Is if the more impossible it feels in that moment, the more you're likely on to something that's really interesting.
And I really like that you said that you got some gifts along the way in writing this. I think those two things go really well together, that if you feel kind of, you know, despondent or I don't know and confused, that going along with, I forget what it was that you said in the Dakota Winners that happened, that you were like, what a gift. That tells me that I'm kind of on the right track and that I should keep going. And, you know, a kind of a sign from the universe that, you know, you're getting there.
Yeah, and to trust that and not to, I mean, Frank Conroy used to say, you know, at the workshop that if it's getting really easy, that's a bad sign. You're just sitting down there, oh, this is the easiest thing I've ever done. He thinks, you're probably going to throw away those pages. So,
right. The more you like what you're writing, the worse off it is.
Isn't it true? I don't know if you've had student writers, but there's that student that comes over to you and tells you how wonderful their story is. And you're always like, oh. And the other story comes and goes, oh, I worked all weekend. I hate this. I don't know what's going on. And they hand you this thing, and you go home with it. It's like, and it's wonderful.
Right. I love it. God, we're drawing down on our time. We had an hour, and I was like, oh, we have all this luxury of time. And then I look at the clock, and I'm like, damn it, I have so much more to talk about. But I don't know if – I know you started out working with Tobias Wolff and some of these other really wonderful – writers, and we've talked about some of the amazing sustaining advice that they've given you over time. Is there some of those more nuggets that we haven't mentioned that we should have mentioned that have really kind of sustained your writing life? That's kind of a big open-ended question, but
yeah, I mean, what I would say is, as students who are, if there are people who are listening or who are studying with various professors, is it's likely that each one of them is going to give you something different and useful. I mean, Conroy had all these great principles. I was lucky to have James Allen McPherson, who was a legendary teacher at Iowa, Pulitzer Prize winning short story writer and essayist. And I've talked to all sorts of friends who've said this, he gave you the larger context of your work. So if you thought you were working in this kind of micro level, all of a sudden he told you the big themes and the sort of lineage you had, where what your work could be, you know, the sort of larger vision of what your work was. And I left my meeting with him feeling like I was a different person and a different writer. And it wasn't anything technical, but it was okay, this is what I'm doing, and I now can write a collection and a novel and all these things. Like, how I'm not just working on this in this minute level. And then I had Marilyn Robinson, who just, you just have the company of her brain in the classroom, and it's just, it's so superior to the rest of the world. You just get to live in this level of fascinating thought and understanding of human nature. And so I'm just saying, be open to getting different things, and don't like criticize them for what they're not providing, because all of them have blind spots, these teachers, and I certainly have mine. But what can you get from each teacher that way? And how can, and as you figure out who you are eventually from a writer, you'll probably be a collection of all those different lessons you've gotten from different people.
Right. It's interesting now that you have two novels, a collection, a nonfiction book. If you can kind of look back over the course of all of that and say, you know, kind of here are my themes, you know, you've had enough kind of time and work out there to say, okay, this is what my brain is kind of caught up and fascinated by. And I don't know if that would help you going forward or if that would hinder you going forward, but it must be a nice feeling to say, I've got a body of work that I can now sort of pick out who I am as a writer and what I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think, you know, you may agree with this, that so it was a very funny process for me. I had these stories, I had these 13 stories, and I'd show them to a friend, and I thought they were completely disparate. And I'd show it to a friend and say, I don't know. I said, did these add up to a collection? And they'd look at me like I was crazy and say, yeah. And I guess my point is, you may not know as you're working that your obsessions are repeating themselves, that the things that you're fascinated are getting, you're coming from different angles, but often at some of the same questions. And I think that that's a good thing. I think that maybe your obsessions in life, you know, can be problematic sometimes if you're over-obsessed about things. But as an artist, to be going at the same things, you know, from different angles and different ways, I think is great. I mean, I often go at issues of identity, class, self-deception. I'm a psychological writer. I'm interested in people who act out in different ways, you know, people who've had a crisis happen to them and haven't processed it and you know, aren't dealing with it entirely, but nonetheless, I kind of respect that because they're not sort of lying in bed. They may be acting out, but at least they're acting and getting on their feet again. And then mostly, I think, just trying to work in that way of being curious about other people. I mean, on top of the world is this nonfiction book where I got thrown into a different world, which is, I mean, this incredible world of loss, which I understood something about, you know, because I'd lost my parents and, you know, I'd had people die in my life. But this business world and also no one was prepared for the amount of things that happened in this small community. And you just have to go in and bring whatever your ability to sort of listen and be interested in other people's stories. So, you know, and allow, you know, your own sensibility into it, but to be able to step back and let other people speak. And that's for me, that's what I want to continue to do.
Well, do it fast so we can have you back on, because this was really fun.
Thank you so much.
This was wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Tom Barbash. The book is The Dakota Winters. It is out and available now, and you can find his other work all over the place. Just look him up on the web, and he's all over the place. He's on Facebook and whatnot. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day, and stay tuned for more jazz coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.